And so we come to the final part of the Ape podcast trilogy. I am the producer of the Bat Segundo Show. Again, Mr. Segundo could not make it this time. He is still being held in the slammer for littering, and we do hope for his inevitable recovery. Personally, I thought that he would be in there for, you know, one of his more serious charges, like, well, we had mentioned the Terrapin incident a couple of shows ago. Jorge is really distraught about this, too. But that's not important. What is important is that we will bring you the finale, the piece de resistance of this trilogy, an interview conducted live with Alex Box Office Poison Tricked Robinson. I hang my head and cry.
Can we start? Should we just allow everyone to talk while we're engaging in very introspective and thoughtful conversation?
I guess we should just get started.
Okay. Hello, everybody. How is everybody doing today? My name is Edward Champion. I'm a writer, and I also am a lip blogger and a podcaster, and this will be available in podcast form. But I'm not important. Well, who is important here is Alex Robinson, who is the author of three books you may know, Box Office Poison, more Box Office Poison, Bop, and lately, Tricked. And as a literary person, I consider Alex to also be sort of literary because of his ambitious narratives, but perhaps we can go ahead and start. So, Alex, Caprice is the character who appears in all three of these books, and I was wondering why she made the cut and the other ones did not.
Well, Caprice originally appeared in that's not her, but...
Well, she's...
it doesn't matter.
Anyway.
Anyway, so Caprice was a character in Box Office Poison who I... originally, she was just going to be in one brief segment where... she was going to show up as an employee at Sherman's bookstore and sort of saying, telling him that if he doesn't like the job, he should quit. And it's, you know, you can do whatever you want. You're responsible for your own happiness. And so sort of demonstrate that she was going to quit. And, you know, just, and.
Here she is right here.
Oh, yeah. That's her very first appearance there. But I found that I had such a fun time writing her, drawing her, that I wanted to bring her back, and she wound up playing a bigger part in the end of at the end of Box Office Poison. And I sort of have an ongoing tradition of taking one character from a previous work and putting them into a new book. So she's the one who made the transition.
Okay. Well, there's also a theme of forgery in this that actually reminded me very much of William Gaddis's The Recognitions.
Right.
It's a very kind of literary kind of topic. But I was curious what drew you to cons and fakes and, you know, people who were involved in self-delusion and the like. And this it's kind of there with Irving Flavor in Box Office Poison, but it's like every single character in Tricked seems to have this very common motif, that, like, they have something on somebody.
Well, self-delusion is my bread and butter, so it's the only way I can get through. Actually, I was more what drew me to the Nick storyline, he forges baseball cards, you know, autographs on baseball cards. I was thinking what it would be like to have a talent that was, if you have, you know, one really great talent, but there's no legal recourse for it. Like, if your one talent was being an excellent forger and counterfeiter, you know, it's not like you can get a straight job doing that, so... But yeah, there was a theme of sort of everyone's lying to each other, and there's all sorts of levels of duplicity in the book. And I don't know. I guess it was just something that, you know, appealed to me. And, you know, once you sort of come up with a, you know, as they say in English class, a theme, you sort of...
Motif.
You try to put it in wherever you can. And, you know, that's sort of how that came to be.
Well, how was the narrative for Tricked constructive? I guess Box Office Poison you did, you know, recurrently over 6 years, and the storylines kind of came out of that, or what happened with the with Tricked? Did you plan the and devise the narrative for this? And
well, with Tricked, for those who aren't familiar with it, it's sort of six different characters whose lives are unconnected, and then they gradually start to overlap until they all come together in one moment at the end of the book. And I was in a diner with my then girlfriend at the time, and you know, I was thinking everyone in this story, everyone in this diner has a story. You know, this person, this guy, maybe just blew all his life savings betting on a horse, and this, the waitress who works there, maybe she's, working her way through college and she's worried about a test, and this guy's an aspiring comedian, and, I sort of figured everyone has a, hopefully interesting story to tell, and that's when I said, well, it'd be interesting to sort of start with that theory and then demonstrate how everyone got to that one point. So it was a much harder to write in that context because everything had to be fit into that structure, and I couldn't, if something else, caught my eye about, oh, maybe I should just have this character go off on this adventure. Well, they have to wind up at that one spot at the end. So that's the challenge. I couldn't have, totally follow my, or if I became bored with the character, I couldn't just drop them.
So you were kind of put these self-imposed restrictions upon yourself by having the outline?
It was, I had, not only did it all wind up in the end, but I told each character had a chapter, which I told in the same order every time. It would go Ray, I can't remember now, Ray, Nick, Phoebe, Caprice.
And those two other characters.
Yes. No, I remember the characters, I just don't remember what order they were in. But, yeah. And then I would, once I did one chapter for each of them, I would start all over again and tell, ABCD. So it was very, it was sometimes agonizing working in that framework. But once I started it, I feel like I couldn't just drop it midway through or anything, so.
Now, you work backwards in this. You go 49 through 1. I was wondering where that came from. It reminded me very much of the Chuck Palahniuk novel Survivor. I don't know if you got it from that.
No, I did. I'd left all the chapter headings blank and until the end of the book, and I was intending to put in, actual titles of the chapters in, I don't know, it just struck me at the end, since it's all sort of builds up to this one event, the sort of backwards chronology sort of, I thought it was kind of a corny idea, but I liked it at the same time. And so that's...
Well, who can resist like any kind of countdown sort of situation?
Right.
Every good science fiction movie. Your books also have like a good deal of cultural references in them, I notice. Often literary and often film. You have, for example, in Trick, there are references to John Steinbeck. And Ray Beam actually goes by Nerdlinger Department Store at one point, which is from The Man Who Wasn't There.
Wow, very, very...
Yeah, I'm a cultural geek, too. You're among friends.
You're paying attention.
But, also in Box Office Poison, you have the Yossarians next door from Catch 22.
Right.
So I was wondering if you can kind of... And I think Apple Tree Cigarettes, which is kind of like Red Apple Cigarettes in Box Office Poison?
And I was trying to... I think I stole that from Pulp Fiction. I think those are the cigarettes.
Yeah, that's what Tarantino does.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, what is the situation in terms of like pop culture as a muse? What provokes these sort of references? How do they kind of? Do you find them? Do they serve as guides or?
Well, I think it's just I think it's more just stuff I like, and it's a way of sort of tipping my hat to influences of the past and things that I enjoy. I also watch movies while I draw, so a lot of times I'll put stuff in just, it'll be very much spur of the moment, putting in a specific reference or, and also I'm sort of a magpie in that I steal from a lot of different, and sometimes I'll put a line in or something and not even realize that I was unconsciously swiping it from a movie or something.
I did see an Army of Darkness line in Box Office Poison. The Jack and Shit and Jack Just Left Town.
Oh, yeah.
There's that, and there was a couple of other things I saw in there. But
Or a lot of times I'll use a line and I'll say, that's a funny line. I'm like, I must have stolen it from somewhere without realizing it.
I have to say, though, you were a lot better. The references were more obscure and Tricked, though.
Well, also with Tricked, I made a conscious effort to I did Box Office Poison, and then I was approached by a publisher in Spain. They wanted to do translation, and they said, oh, we just have a couple of questions about, some of the pop cultural references or slang or something. And it was like 400 questions they sent me. What does Kiss My Grits mean? Who is, who is Gumby? Who is, all these kind of questions. And I'm like, it was so depressing realizing how much, I was just sort of, I don't know just how much, but I was just sort of going for a cheap reference or something like that. So with Tricked, I was like, I'm going to totally make it a fake universe like all the movie references, all the song references, all the band references, and that was really hard because the music business plays a big part. So towards the end of the book, I'm like, I got to come up with another clever band name to,
Well, you know, I have to say, though, about cultural references, I know that the Beatles are referenced very explicitly in Box Office Poison. I was wondering if Beam was possibly inspired by John Lennon to some degree, given the end, which we won't reveal. And in fact, it's not like the real life. Maybe you could talk about this.
Well, my first sort of attempt at the story was I called it Sophomore Slump, and it was very much more John Lennon sort of oriented. In that version of the story, Caprice became the personal assistant to this reclusive rock star, and he had this image of sort of being one way, and then she met him and she was like, oh my god, he's a total scumbag, and he's like this Howard Hughes-ish, you know. It was sort of inspired by
it was Caprice instead of Lily then initially.
Yes, Caprice was going to be the personal assistant, and it was inspired by the John Lennon biography Lives of Lennon by Albert Goldman. Uh-huh. Who I don't know if anyone's even familiar with that anymore. When it came out, it was very controversial because this guy was saying Lennon and Yoko were big liars, that, you know, they claimed to be living this happy house husband lifestyle, yeah, but that John Lennon was really a heroin addict all those years, and that's why he was not going in public. And, you know,
there was
really,
he weighed like 120 pounds or something, yeah, and it was a secret kept by Yoko. I remember this.
Well, he did get very, very thin towards the end of his life on his macrobiotic diet and all that stuff. But so I was interested in exploring that sort of like the dichotomy between the public, you know, public image relations and the behind-the-scenes stuff. So, but I sort of toned that down a bit in the final version of the book.
What made you sort of create Lily instead of Caprice for the personal assistant, the muse? Because it's a very interesting predicament that, which I'll ask a follow-up first to reveal.
I'm not sure exactly. The Lily character, I had a hard time starting my second book. And the Lily character was actually in an earlier second book of mine called Cave City, where Lily and her sister Ivy were living in the small town in New Mexico, and their names were actually switched at the time, because Ivy and Lily are both in the book, but they have different names, and Ivy was more of the main character. But now the sister took. So I think just certain characters just grab you, and you're like, I'm going to work with them, even though I'm not quite sure what they're going to do. And I'm not sure why I switched it from Caprice. I think I was more interested in doing a pre-story that focused more on her personal life and her sort of the problem as a guy I observe with a lot of women is that they sort of go for bad boys, and I was sort of, you know, someone you think is totally intelligent and charming and stuff, and she's like, yeah, I'm going out with this guy. He's a drug dealer who beats me. You know, you're like, what? So,
well, Caprice, I mean, she not only almost gets seduced by Nick, but also Sherman in Box Office Poison.
Right, yeah.
In fact, this is a kind of common motif I wanted to ask you about in terms of you have these women who are taken in by dupes and charlatans and mm-hmm. dicks, and, you know, right. Maybe you can, you know, why is this, you know, sort of a common sort of reference point for you with regard to women?
Well, I don't know if it's just the women. I mean, well,
they seem to have like self-assertion issues, a lot of your female characters, I've found it.
I don't know. It's if you look at the other point of view, you could say Sherman is, you know, in the first book, everyone hated Dorothy in the first book, so that was certainly a case of everyone being, oh my God, she's such a bitch, you know, she's an evil influence. And I don't know. I don't know, sympathy, sort of like a way of sort of like a warning or something. I don't know, sort of like saying like, you know, I can appreciate, you know, that you have these good qualities, but and you shouldn't be selling yourself short or getting, you know, I don't quite know what it is exactly.
Maybe sort of like this is a self-help book, actually. So women do not be attracted to these particular types of...
Well, not a self-help book, because I've personally...
I mean, not, yeah, you know what I mean.
Yeah. It wasn't a conscious effort on my part, but you know, maybe that's, you know, some part of it. So,
well, the other thing about, speaking of Dorothy, the messy apartment motif, it's like this is the bat signal that some characters really screwed up to some degree. I was wondering if you could talk about this. It's one of those Balzacian sort of indicators, you know.
Well, when I started the character Dorothy in Box Office Poison, she was very much a She was originally inspired by Dorothy Parker, who was a slob in her own mm-hmm. personal life. But I needed some more, like, something more personal and firsthand. So I actually modeled a lot of her behavior on a roommate of mine at the time, who was definitely the biggest slob I've ever lived with in my entire life. We had three cats living with us, and she would never scoop the litter box. It was like overflowing with Tootsie Rolls, and she would never, you know, she would always use everyone else's toilet paper, so everyone learned to stop putting communal toilet paper out. So she was using like coffee filters as toilet paper. It was like, oh, you know, horrifying stuff. So I just decided to have some fun with that and apply it to Dorothy.
Well, I put up this panel too because this is also a very common motif where you have balloons over each other, mm-hmm. With text balloons, you know, and this is kind of you could sometimes be very, very wordy, and I'm just wondering if you've set sort of any kind of rules between this and also sometimes these getting to know you conversations. Let's see if we could find one here. Like this, for example. Here's where Sherman and Dorothy in Box Office Poison are getting to know each other.
Right.
And you have these very long sort of interesting text of small talk about how they get together. And I was wondering if you could kind of elaborate on both the balloons and also how the use of text in your work.
Well, I think of myself as a writer first and an artist second. So I'm more story driven. And with pages like this, it's pretty much just a matter of economy. You know, if you want to have a first date and people getting to know each other, or any, you know, a scene with two people sitting in a bar talking to each other, or in that case, three characters talking to each other, you know, if you stretch that out to like real time, it would be, you know, pages and pages and pages of just people sitting at a bar talking to each other, which gets very monotonous to draw and to read. So it's really just a way of sort of condensing, you know, what would be, you know, 40 pages worth of dialogue into, you know, and just sort of giving a greatest hits of a conversation as opposed to, you know, an entire thing. It's more of a problem solving for storytelling kind of issue. But
well, you also, like, for example, I want to talk about your use of balloons. You have, like, sometimes the chill kind of sign when someone is speaking very angrily. You,
right.
of course, have the standard kind of whispering balloon.
Yeah.
But, the balloons are overlapping each other. Is this sort of a Dave Sim kind of influence?
Or yeah, well, Dave Sim was definitely a huge influence on my work in terms of storytelling not his politics necessarily.
Well,
but,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
I still think even up until the end, he was a brilliant cartoonist. He would do a lot of that. I definitely learned a lot of, he worked with a lot of word balloon, much more extreme than anything I do in terms of, you know, each character would have their own font or, you know, depending on how they were speaking, the font would be sort of more, you know, sort of formal script or something like that. So, it's just tools from the toolbox. You know, you say, oh, wow, that guy really did a good job with that. I'm going to, you know, use that next time I need to do something. And, you know, you just take, you know, we're all working, all the cartoonists are working to the same, you know, to solve the same problem. So if someone solves it in a good way and you're like, you know, that's a good trick.
Well, if we're talking about you as a developing cartoonist, there was one thing I actually wanted to ask you. You said in the interview with Alex Ness that you felt that the 4 years you spent at the School of Visual Arts was a waste of time. and you alluded to the idea that the students there had no work ethic, no talent. I'm just curious, based off of that, you know, well, what kind of education does, like, say, an aspiring cartoonist here in the crowd or anywhere else need to have?
Well, fine-tune the SVA comment, it's not a matter of no one had any work ethic or talent. It was more of a matter, I thought it was more of a boot camp thing where they really pushed you hard, and it was like summer camp, you know, for kids. I knew a kid who did a project in his freshman year, and he was recycling it every year and use it all the way through his senior year. Okay, do a 10-page story. He would bust out the same 10-page story every year. So, yeah, I was very disappointed with that level of, you know, because when you're 19 years old, you only want to work as hard as the teachers, you know, demand of you. I think now I get more out of it because I have a better work ethic. But, I think I learned a lot more in the first year after graduation than I did in the 4 years previously, because just putting out, you know, I told myself, I'm going to do a quarterly comic. I'm going to produce 80 pages of comics a year, you know, while working a job and everything. And you learn a lot more, just draw, just be as productive as you can. I think, you know, if just putting that much work into anything, you'll really learn fast. You know, I think Gil Kane once said that everyone has 10,000 bad drawings or something in them. So you have to go through all those 10,000 bad drawings, and the 10,001 drawing, you'll be a good artist. If you draw 10,000 pictures, the 10,001st will be, just from sheer volume. So.
Well, you mentioned, we were talking about Dave Sim earlier. What other sort of artists out there are you really heavily influenced by? For Box Office Poison or even for Tricked, which is a little bit more on the Baroque side of things. Yeah.
For Box Office Poison, there's a cartoonist named Terry Laban, who did a series called Unsupervised Existence in the early 90s, which I thought was fantastic. It very much saddened me to read later on that he was like, I hated doing that series, and he had very bad memories of it. But for me, it was really a sort of way of indicating a kind of tone of story, a sort of lighthearted, real-life kind of quality that I really, humorous but reality-based kind of comics. The first time I read Harvey Pekar's stuff, I was totally blown away. His is much more naturalistic than anything I, ever do. The usual, Dan Clowes, Peter Bagg, kind of Joe Matt, Chester Brown, that early 90s sort of alternative comics scene was all, influential.
Well, there's also, though, a sort of ethical dilemma situation throughout much of your work, particularly like, for example, does Ed take the job at Zoom Comics, or, the whole forgery of Nick in Tricked. So maybe you might want to talk about, do you feel that you need to sort of instill a sense of ethics in your work, or do these things kind of crop up because that's just the nature of your sort of, conversational sort of, that's the nature of the brew, so to speak? Or?
Well, I think it's just sort of that's what makes for interesting, people making tough choices is what makes for interesting, drama. It's just, someone else had said that my stories are very sort of
parable-like.
Yeah, they have a very sort of moral tone to it, and again, it's not a conscious thing. I'm thinking, this time I'm going to address people, not holding.
This
up
time it's
agreements.
The war on drugs.
Yeah, it's a friend of mine pointed out that what makes Sherman's story in Box Office Poison so sad is that he does all the right things.
Yeah.
He's with this horrible girlfriend, but he says, loyalty is important. You stick with someone even if they might have some problems, and it's sort of his undoing. So it's a kind of ethically gray area. So,
well, there's one thing I wanted to actually ask you about that's been actually bothering me now for about a number of years, and that's the where is it here?
Oh boy.
I'm sorry to do this, but I'm really curious. It's the end of Marl. I think here it is.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, this I when I first read this, I was just shocked. I mean, this is pretty dark. We see. You either really hated the character or there's some sort of dark streak. Maybe you could talk about this.
For those not familiar with the book, there's a character in it named Marlise, who's a runaway girl, and her and her friend are sort of a recurring, very minor supporting characters in the book, and towards the end of the book, she is murdered.
Yeah.
And the whole inclusion of the runaways was a very, people seem to either be indifferent to it or say, why was that in there? I had no business being in there. But I really saw it as sort of a parallel to the Sherman and Ed, the main story, mm-hmm. because at a certain point in the story, Marlise and Cookie, her friend, Cookie says, "You know what? I can't live on the streets anymore. I'm gonna go. I have to go home. It might be bad, but this is not gonna work out." And Marlise is very furious and says, "Fuck you. I can't believe you're going back to that. I'm gonna stay true to my own, plan." And so her story is sort of a parallel for Sherman's story. Ed and Sherman are both faced with questions of loyalty. Ed is like, do I stay loyal to Flavor even though he's going back to the people who betrayed him? And he says, no, I'm not going to do that. Sherman says, do I be loyal to my girlfriend even though she's horrible? Yes, I'm going to remain loyal to her. Marlise says, I'm going to remain loyal to living on the streets. And so that's sort of a harsher, brutal parallel to Sherman's dilemma. So that was my thinking of it anyway.
Oh, I just was wondering if somehow some of the kind of light comic sort of tone was kind of disguising or masking. I mean, because it kind of, this dark streak kind of comes out and tricked with the Steve character,
mm-hmm.
who actually I find not just to be a dangerous character, but also a very sad figure, you know?
Right.
And maybe you can talk about how the sort of this dark streak is kind of, perhaps, is it, do you find that it's cloaked by sort of your kind of natural comic exuberance, or your...
I met the cartoonist John Kovalik one time, who does a humorous book called Dork Tower, and he said he was amazed when he met me at how jolly I was based on the tone of my book. And I don't know, maybe it's just a way of getting all that out and dealing with it. With the Steve character in Tricked, who gradually goes insane over the course of the book, I was just really interested I'm fascinated by lucid, crazy people who have like a weird belief, and you're like trying to talk to them and figure out where the jump from, you know, where the break in reality comes. And so I was very fascinated by that, and trying to write from the first person someone going crazy. It was shockingly easy to do. The Steve chapters always came very fast, and were,
wow.
You know, I could do that all day. So,
well, and also the lettering was a little easier, perhaps, because you could be a little sloppier.
The beginning, I wanted to have the lettering and the border panel borders mirror his inner, you know, thing. So I was definitely, by the end, I was just lettering it totally freehand, you know, just crossing out mistakes instead of whiting it out. The borders were not penciled at all. They were just totally, you know, done freehand. And that was a lot of fun to do.
Well, I don't know what our time situation is like, but what I'll do is I think I'll open the floor to questions in just 1 second. But actually, before we do that, I actually have the Eisner-Picar questionnaire. James Lipton has the Proust questionnaire. We have a new one. This one is far more ridiculous, I hope, anyway.
So this will be all short answers?
This will be short answers, okay. Yes. So if the fight music from Amok Time played in the background, what two historical figures, living or dead, would you have duking it out with each other?
Theodore Roosevelt and Adolf Hitler.
Okay. Han shoots first, apocryphal or necessary?
Necessary.
Really? Okay.
Definitely. How could you even ask that question?
I don't know. The Daily Comic Strip, 3 panels or 4?
4.
Okay. And what is your favorite Batman sound effect?
Thwack.
Okay. And how many comic books do you own?
Oof. Comic, like floppies or including graphic novels?
Yeah, maybe. I'm just what figure but works best for you?
Well, floppies are probably easier. I have like about 4 or 5 long boxes.
Wow.
So that's about, that's including all my superhero stuff. But I probably have, you know, I have hundreds of graphic, I probably have 2 bookcases, you know, a lot of graphic novels. So I know that wasn't as quick as...
Oh, that's all right. And finally, perhaps the most important question, is DC's Infinite Crisis an innovative reinvention or a cheap marketing ploy?
You know, to tell you the truth, I don't even know what it is.
They're doing another sort of continuity
a crossover.
Yeah, exactly. Continuity overhaul. So anyway,
I couldn't comment having not seen.
Okay.
It, but,
okay.
You know.
Well, does anyone here have any questions for Alex? No, no pressing questions. I've got questions here, but I would love to hear if you guys have questions. Anyone? Aha, gentleman in the back.
Well, I guess everyone heard the question. It's basically, what are my attitudes towards conventions? As in my box office poison, you know, they go to a big convention at the end. I think by the time I'd done that, I'd just gone to the Pittsburgh Comic Con, which is sort of a medium-sized show, mostly mainstream stuff. Up until then, I'd done small press type shows like this. So that was the first time I'd been to a show where people were dressed up in costumes, and you know, there were washed-up movie stars and wrestlers and stuff like that, and. I don't know sort of what attitude you took from the book, but I generally enjoy going to shows. Sometimes it can be very depressing when you're standing at your table and no one comes by for, you know, a long time and you don't sell any books, but I still generally enjoy going to them. And I actually enjoy going to the mainstream shows more because it's just fun stuff to see. Like, oh, that's the kid from Willy Wonka. Look, he's 50 years old now. And, you know, and I'll always say, you know, I have a soft spot in my heart for toys and superhero comics and stuff like that. So I generally do have a pretty good time.
Any questions? Or I'll ask one. Sure. You were mentioning to me in an email that you are a very harsh critic of your work, and maybe you might, Alex Robinson the critic might comment upon Alex Robinson the artist. Where is the room for improvement, and where what works, what doesn't?
Generally, it can all be improved. It's mostly like I can't look at my old work. Like when I look at pages from Box Office Poison, the early pages, you know, 12 years ago, I can't even look at them. They just seem so, like, all I see are the mistakes. Oh, the arm is all the wrong position. The line work is thin. But I can see some good stuff in it. But I don't know. I really would, you know, love to be a better artist, but I don't feel or I don't have the patience to put the work into that it really requires. So, you know, I get by with the excuse that I'm a writer first and, you know, the art serves the story, which I think it genuinely does. You know, I'm as good an artist as I need to be for the stories I'm telling. So,
well, this up here is one of the many sort of Box Office Poison questions. Well, this is probably one of the strangest and most entertaining ones.
That actually is one of my favorite ones.
But I was wondering, what was this kind of like the natural end? Because I noticed that in BOP, there's the 24-hour comic you did, and this was like the tail end. So when you did one of these stories, was this always sort of the last thing you did? Or maybe you could talk about how these kind of came to be.
Dan Clowes and 8-Ball used to do a... Okay, first there was a zine called Duplex Planet Illustrated where this guy he worked in a nursing home and he would ask these old people questions and they had these crazy answers. You know, he'd say like, you know, he would just say, I can't think of any examples of hand, of course, but he would ask them a question, you know, what is a guitar? And the old people would just talk about guitars and music. And it was kind of like old people say the craziest things kind of thing. Not senile crazy things, but just, you know... And Dan Clowes did an adaptation of that in 8-Ball where he would essentially ask, you know, what is a guitar? And then he would have an excerpt of all the old people talking and with their answers. So I kind of like that as a character exploration gimmick of, you know, asking one question and having... It's a way of getting to know the characters for the reader to get to know them and for me to get to know them. So they were a lot of fun to do. I started doing them for Trick too, but it just was too hard because I didn't want to duplicate any questions from Box Office Poison. Yeah. And
well, also the tone was totally different in Trick. It's kind of like a dramedy, so to speak, I guess.
Right. Yeah. Box Office Poison is a bit more lighthearted for the most part. Other than Runaways being murdered, it's a bit more lighthearted. But yeah. So I put the one in the 24-hour comic just because I needed one more page to fill. So. You know, after 24 hours.
This is another odd question, but every cartoonist I have spoken with, you know, has expressed a great love for Planet of the Apes. Mm-hmm. And as we see here, Abe's key pivotal moment during conquest of Planet of the Apes between Ed and Hildy.
Right.
discuss the Planet of the Apes, perhaps, or maybe you might offer a theory as to why apes and cartoonists seem to mix. I don't know.
I really couldn't. For me, it goes back to, I guess it's mostly a nostalgic thing, because when I was a kid, New York City, they used to have the 4:30 movie every week, and every week would be a different theme they'd do. And the two, you know, Romance Week, Army Week, whatever, and as a kid, the two we loved the most were Monster Week and Planet of the Apes Week. So Planet of the Apes Week, they would show Monday, they would show Planet of the Apes, Tuesday they would show, and so every after, you know, you had a whole week of Planet of the Apes, and I guess it was the first sort of like Lord of the Rings-ish, you know, saga that people had, that, you know, kids could have access to. So I think that's probably a lot of it, and, you know, apes are just cool looking. In this specific scene you're talking about where they go see Conquest of the Planet of the Apes, which is probably my second favorite one after the first one, I actually have this being the director's cut where, because in the original version of Conquest of the Planet of the Apes, you know, it's basically just like the apes are like, we're here to kill all the humans, dun dun, the end. And everyone, when they showed it to people, they were horrified. So they put in a sort of cushier ending of saying we have to kill all the humans, but you know what, let's live in peace and harmony, and so I really like the first version better, and it's truer to the story because the apes do kill all the humans. Yeah. so then in this scene I have them watching the mythical director's cut where they call for the destruction of humans, and that's the end. So.
Questions out there, anyone? Okay. Oh, sorry. Go for it.
Yeah, the question was, since I consider myself a writer first and an artist second, would I ever consider just writing straight up, prose? And I've thought about it. I enjoy drawing, though. I mean, the feeling of finishing a page is the best feeling, ever of a good page being done. And also, I don't think I'm a good enough writer to to really just do straight prose. I'm a good enough writer and a good enough artist for comics. I'm mediocre at both. So when you put them together, it adds up to better. So,
well, at the same time, though, you're also here's something from Bop right here, which I think is a very experimental, where you get two sort of perspectives. Sherman's telling the story, and his ex-girlfriend is telling the story, and they seem to be having different opinions. You could see that Sherman is bald on the sort of sixth panel right there to the right, where he has a full head of hair to the left,
and maybe
you could talk about sort of like, you know, how experimental of a cartoonist, or what do you try to do to sort of do things like this, or is this kind of a way to kind of, you know, maybe think a little bit outside of the box, or what's
I think it's basically just sort of a way to have some fun with the storytelling angle of, that sort of, which of those is the true thing. It was just sort of a fun way to do it to just have their different versions, sort of like that movie Rashomon, I guess, which I've never actually seen, I have to confess. But
that's okay.
But, I was sort of piecing together a story based on other people's conflicting testimony, and it's just fun to draw people looking distorted from the way they really look. So
we have time for one more question. Does anyone in the crowd have something?
Just when you first were starting Box Office Poison, you were, if I remember right, you started it as sort of mini comics, mm-hmm. kind of scenes, right? Is sort of that how you intended it? You just kind of got roped into making a sort of comic book form, or is that what you're actively sort of seeking or saw going out?
Well, I'd always wanted to be I always wanted to be published for real, and for real, snobby way of saying it.
For real, man.
I didn't want to be one of those loser mini comics people. my intention was always to sort of get published and to eventually do. As I said, Dave Sim was a big influence, so the idea of doing a thick comic book was, I really liked that format and really getting to get in depth with the characters and stuff. So. Does that pretty much answer your question? Or did you?
Kind of. I'm just curious, how long did you see yourself going just on sort of the mini comics alone? Why did you start with that instead of just going straight to doing a comic book kind of thing?
I really didn't have any timeline. Like, I would do mini comics for this time. It was just more like, I just want to get published, and I'm going to keep sending my mini comics, four mini comics a year, hoping eventually to get published, and if that didn't work out, I would, theoretically self-publish once it became enough for a trade paperback. I really don't like dealing with the business end of it, which is, dealing with Diamond and printers, and, I know nothing about computers, so the idea of scanning work, I don't know how you even give artwork to a printer, here you go, put this into a book for me. So, the mini comics were a great, I think, they're a great format also for just showing your stuff to publishers and getting, getting the word out. They're cheap. You could print up a batch at a time. And,
Did that kind of influence how the story developed, do you think?
I think just the serialization angle was different. Not necessarily mini comics versus, full press or whatever the title would be. When it's serialized, you feel like you have to end everything on a sort of cliffhanger, resolve stuff. So, with Tricked, it was much more, which I did not serialize at all. It was very much more, I could have a scene go as long as short as I wanted. I could build it up slower as opposed to having to, get people in immediately. So actually the first 60 pages of the book, the first 10% of the book are not really a one cohesive story. It's a bunch of vignettes with all the characters. And then about page 60, I said, okay, I've come up with a good story for these characters. Let me go in that direction. So you could really cut out the first 60 pages and not lose anything of the story itself.
I think that's it, unfortunately. But thank you very much, Alex, and thank you very much, audience, for being here.
I'll be at the Top Shelf table for about the next half hour.
So. Yeah, check him out at the Top Shelf table.
Nothing to do. I like fun for free and a ice cold brew. I like to watch football on TV. I like